page 337. Women. Hamsun belittles Ibsen's women and thumbs his nose at Ibsen himself for his description of Nora in a doll's house. I know a sage, and he wrote of women in 30 volumes of uniform theater poetry. I counted the volumes once in a big bookcase, and at least he wrote of the women who left her own children to go in search of the wonderful. But what then were the children? Oh, it was comical. A wanderer laughs at anything so comical. Footnote 63. Text. Women attains fulfillment of her destiny when she limits her functions of those of a housewife and mother. This enshrinement of biological function leads Hamsun to bitter hatred for any emancipation, intellectuality, or political reform that women might desire. Footnote 64. Text. And finally, in an attack on actresses to utter contempt for the modern women. You ladies pretend to look down on domestic life, pretend to be indifferent to the scanty personal respect you enjoy. You are either not mothers at all or very bad ones, either incapable of bringing up children or pitifully incompetent at it. Every day of your lives you sink into deeper shame on account of this impotence. That is the truth. Footnote 65. Text. The ideal peasant woman, wife of the ideal peasant in growth of the soil, unpleasant in appearance and not always faithful, has a meaningful existence as a housewife and mother, a good nature, a clever nature. Footnote 66. Text. The Margravine is indoors preparing the meal, tall and stately as she moves about her house, a vestal tending the fire of a kitchen stove. Inger has made her stormy voyage, 'tis true, has lived in a city a while, but now she is home. Footnote 67. Text. This theme is constantly reiterated. Woman receives her true consecration as a mother. Of the tragic ruin of a woman who thought to run away from an unsatisfying marriage, only this is said. She has no occupation, but has three maid servants to her house. She has no children, but she has a piano. But she had no children. Footnote 68. Text. It is another woman, a paragon of mediocrity, who receives the accolade. A mother many times realizing life, it was worthy of a great reward. Footnote 69. Text. Page 338. In such idealization of fertility, biology takes precedence over the convention of middle-class morality. As in the case of Inger, sexual vicissitudes are blinked, indeed are condoned, provided the end of denouement is the producing children. This was also stuck in trade of the Nazi ideology, which reduced womanhood to a biological function. Hamsun's language becomes almost epic when he speaks of women as the bearer of progeny. She becomes a fertility heroine. A real girl shall marry, shall become the wife of a man, shall become a mother, shall become a blessing to herself. Footnote 70. Text. Urban society. The idolatry of nature is set up against a world where cheating goes on in the dark. Footnote 71. Text. The composition of this rejected world is quite apparent. It is in brief an inventory of modern urban society that Hamsun condemns industry. Footnote 72. Text. Public officials. Footnote 73. Text. The natural sciences. Footnote 74. Text. The teaching professions. 75. The coffee house. 76. The corporation. 77. In countries under liberal governments, as well as the city, the intellectuals, the workers, and platforms of social reforms, these are all surveyed in the novels and dismissed as hateful. Significant, for example, are his contemptuous remarks on Gladstone, footnote 78, in his rejection of the modern type of man of our time, who believes all the Jew and the Yankees have taught him, footnote 79, text. He has warm words of praise for Sweden because he is oriented toward Germany, not toward Switzerland, footnote 80, text, and he tells the English that they will someday be whipped to death by the healthy destiny of Germany, footnote 81, text. Numerous are his attacks on Switzerland, not just coincidentally. The model of democratic experimentation. In one of his novels, a man plans to build a comfortable home for his family in the Swiss fashion. He is taken to task by Hamsun for believing he can learn something. From a miserable little people up in the Alps, a people that throughout its history has never been or done anything worth speaking of. Footnote 82, text. These attacks are typical of a romanticizing primitivism, anticipating in literature the sneering propaganda of the Middle European authoritarian parties against effeminacy and the mores of the big cities. Page 339. When Hamsun assumes the posture of social critique, he focuses his attention only on superficial, secondary aspects of industrial society. Everything the inquiring mind finds of interest and of crucial importance, including considerations for mutual help, is flattened out or swept away with an imperious gesture. Not accidentally, a chief butt of his ridicule are the manufacturers of consumer goods, whom he epitomizes in those who seem most readily to lend themselves to caricature, such as producers of canned goods, candies, and herring meal, footnote 83, text. Butter, he asks. One did not churn butter anymore. One went to the store and bought margarine. Storehouse and shed full of meat, pork and fish. One would have died of laughter at anybody who kept salt meat. Wasn't there food to be had in tins? Tin food? It was ready cooked. It was chewed too. It was ready to put into a cloth to make a child's sucker for all of mankind. What did mouth want with teeth anymore? Weren't there false teeth hanging on a string in the toothmaker's shop? And as for the tinned foods, it dealt gently with people who had already got stomach trouble from eating it. Footnote 84, text. Middle class. For Hamsun, intellectuals and public officials exemplify middle-class trivialty. The work of the journalist, the teacher, and the historian find no favor in his eyes. Footnote 85. Text. Scientists are represented as having wrought a permanent injury against men. Science is an empty mechanism, an incomprehensible hodgepodge of data. Footnote 86. Text. The brunt of the attack is on civil servants and clerks in general. Footnote 87. Text. Officials, believe me, they are a miserable tribe, nothing but mediocre abilities and stunted energies. The triumph of the commonplace. Footnote 88. Text. In the midst of a hymn to nature, I am never done with grass and stones. Hamsun plunges into an attack on the sons of clerics, the official residence, and the garden of the commonplace, where everything is decided on account of age, length of service, and school learning. Footnote 89, text. With such useless hands as theirs, which they could turn to no manual labor, they could only sit in an office writing. Such servile work as writing the letters of the alphabet. The most that can befall them is to fail in an examination. I pity them bent over a table so long as they are round-shouldered. They are helpless with their hands. They generally wear glasses, a sign that a learning poured into their brains. It sucked the sight from their eyes. Footnote 90, text. Page 340. Now, as we see the clerk, the bureaucrat, the intellectual portrayed as sickly, decadent, impotent, there emerges by implication the counter-image of the self-assured, vigorous, nor tough, Nordic hero. Those who do not display these virtues are similarly disqualified. Working class. Contempt for factory workers and for workers' movements permeates Hamsun's novels. It first appears in the disguise of his romanticizing naturalism. What was more, I like to be among field and forest, not with lumbermen and proletariat. Footnote 91, text. But soon in the same novel, the disguise falls away and resentment comes to the fore. These gentlemen of the proletariat think a good deal of themselves. They look down on farm workers and have nothing to do with them. Then, too, they are more popular among the girls. It is the same with men working on roads or railways, with all factory hands. Footnote 92, text. This contemptuous sarcasm remains a key motive. In one of his last novels we read, the moment that Alex has found himself with a job and with money in his pocket, food in his belly, and clothes on his back, he had crawled to his feet and began stalking around like a man, had even applied for membership in the trade union, to which he pointed with considerable pride. Footnote 93, text. The competitive interwovenness of urban lower strata appears as a threat to the heroic status quo, life on the soil. The others, the working men, businessmen, the day laborers, go about showing their teeth at one another and fighting. That is life. They are really fighting over the old landowner. They are fighting over his possession. Footnote 94, text. Page 341. For Hamsun, the struggle for an increase in material welfare is merely vulgar. Whatever rational justifications such claims may have is no concern of his. He engages in a variety of attacks on the proletariat's strong and blind craving for food. Footnote 95. Text. On the road of the masses, who unfortunately have learned from mechanical reading and writing how beautiful it is to live by others' labor. Footnote 96, text. But worst of all are the destructive tendencies that are bound up with the working man's worldly greed. They, the masses, want to roar and turn things upside down, and when it comes to a pinch, even their own leaders can't hold them in. The whole thing is crashing. Let it crash. Footnote 97, text. Here, indeed, we are face to face with the nihilistic furor of the authoritarian mentality. Nihilism, anti-intellectualism. At the peak of liberalist optimism, popular manifestations of confidence in scientific progress made the coffee houses and beer halls the layman's university, with natural science, medicine, and politics the favorite subject in the curriculum. True, these flourishing ideas were without influence not only in the groves of academe, but in society at large. Still, the constant critical concern with the affairs of science and public life served to perpetuate a confidence in the efficacy of each member of society. The incomprehensibility and inexorability of the social process has increasingly given rise to pseudo-philosophies and pseudo-sociologies which claim to possess superior wisdom, keys to the mystery of human relationships, recipes for the best and quickest possibly solution of men's dilemmas. The attraction in recent decades of innumerable panaceas for curing the ills of the world through programs which promises to discover the meaning of life in nature, illustrates this trend. Nudism, astrology, dietary, and breathing fads are cases in point. Man seeks to draw from nature the meaning he cannot find in society. Page 342. At the same time, the results of science and education are often not experienced by broad strata of the population as aids to progress. What was actually to be gained from the work of the natural scientists, from the apparatus of school and other cultural institutions? So people ask, to the extent that these activities seemed unrelated to universal improvement in material welfare, an impression grew that learning was an empty program, busy work, or pointless pastime.